Good evening, everyone, and welcome. It is an honor to share this evening with all of you, and it's a distinct honor for us to welcome, for the first time since taking on his role as the president of Yeshiva University, of Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, a distinguished guest. The first time I had the chance to meet with Rabbi Dr. Berman, just the two of us, he asked me a question for which I was somewhat unprepared. He asked me, "What are you learning in the Kollel?" He said, "Tell me a little bit about the sugya that you were discussing." He wanted to understand the limud, the Torah, the Gemara, the Halacha that was happening in the Kollel. That had never happened before. Because Rabbi Berman is a true Talmud Chacham and a person who is personally oriented to growth in Limud HaTorah. But at the same time as being Rabbi Berman, the Talmud Chacham, the person who's interested in the learning aspect, he's also Dr. Berman. He's also the individual who has the scholarship and the understanding of the nuance of the world in which we live to be able to navigate it as complicated as it is and is becoming daily. And so as the person who sits at the helm of the foremost institution in the world in engaging the world in which we live through the values, the timeless values of Torah, he has the embodiment of that mission. And it's an honor to welcome you, and it's a kavod gadol, a huge honor for our dinner tonight. But we could even add that on a personal level, his coming to Chicago is, although different from New York, is in a certain sense, intellectually, spiritually, it's very much at home. Because the values of our kollel, of Limud HaTorah, of engaging the community with our values, and specifically partnering with Torah Mitzion, bringing the prism of religious Zionist outlooks to all that we do, is really the hallmark of his synthesis. Because he himself served in the capacity as a Mora Hora, as a Rav, as a Manig in America, and then in a different but also influential capacity in Israel before becoming the president of YU. So as a Yeshiva University and Torah Mitzion Kollel, we think that it is very fitting that we have the honor to welcome the Chavad Gadol, Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman.
Thank you so much. It is truly a pleasure and privilege to be here with you this evening. I have to say that after landing this morning and experiencing firsthand the mild winters of Chicago, I will be here every February just to walk around without a coat. But more than enjoying the weather, the people, the community, and the spirit, and specifically the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel. You know, it is a real gift to watch from afar and up close the enormous success of this endeavor. And I know that there are many people that are responsible for this success. I know that there are many lay leaders here who work deeply to ensure that Torah be brought into this community in such a way. I know that this kollel enjoys the great support by the incredible rabbis of this community who have blessed this kollel with, as part of their broader operations and broader mission of bringing Torah into this community. And while there are many to thank, I just want to point out only one for now. And that is the incredible, absolutely brilliant, immersed deeply in Torah, embodying the character of everything that we stand for, that your very own Rabbi Reuven Brandt. We are so proud of what Rabbi Brandt is doing here, what he stands for, his reputation here in our community, in our broader community. It really gives us such confidence in our future to know that these are the Talmidei Chachamim and great rabbinic leaders that are emerging from Yeshiva University. It's very exciting for us to have young men who are sitting under his tutelage, who are kolel, many of our kolel students, who then afterwards many stay on in Chicago and in this community as a way of continuing the spirit and the ruach of everything that the YU Torah Mitzion Kolel stands for. And this whole project is one of great joy for us, and we're excited that it exists, we're excited that it's prospering, and I'm personally excited to be here with you to enjoy this wonderful celebration of this endeavor. So thank you so much for inviting me to this great evening. You know, it speaks to the values of this community and this kolel, that the dinner begins with a shir. You know, I've been asked to speak and address at other dinners, but I've never asked to come and give a shir beforehand. And I think that is exactly the type of spirit, the learning, the limud, that this whole enterprise, you know, what it stands for, and starting with a shir, is certainly representative of the values of this great kolel. So I want to begin talking about a topic that I think is, in some sense, the most pressing for us. You know, we live today with a number of significant challenges and opportunities that never existed before, that are unprecedented in Jewish history. And it's true in many respects. But tonight, what I want to focus on is our community vis-a-vis the broader Jewish world and all of society. And to get there, I'll address a medieval situation, a story that happened in medieval Europe that, while very different than our context today, I think gives gives some parallel examples that are reflective and instructive for our days as well. So let me just start, before I get to the medieval context, with a story that just happened to me at Yeshiva University. One of the most surprising things about Yeshiva University is how many people are interested in our success. Now, I've seen this from Jews, certainly across the country, but what's really surprising is when it comes from non-Jews. I've had so many occasions where non-Jews came to me to explain to me and tell me how important Yeshiva University is. I remember I was meeting the president of Fordham University, Father Joe McShane, and he said to me that Yeshiva University is so important that when you go and raise money from donors, take me with you. I will explain it. I thought, what a great scene. The priest and the rabbi walks into the room and raises money for Yeshiva University. Now, of the astonishing experiences are those that come and visit Yeshiva University. We've had visits by imams. We've had visits by the U.S. military and visits by the Christian hierarchy to come and learn and see how we are transmitting the Masorah to the next generation. So about a year ago, the Archbishop of Paris came with a cohort of Parisian priests to Yeshiva University to meet with me, with other Rashi Yeshiva, with our Jewish faculty, and to see how we're actually transmitting the Masorah. One of the stops along the tour was to go visit the Beit Midrash. And they walked into the Beit Midrash, into the second floor of the Beit Midrash, overlooking all the students studying. One of the priests came over to me and said, "Listen, I understand what they're doing. It has deep religious significance. It's very meaningful. Can you explain to me, what is the religious significance of this?" I said, "I don't know, but it's very successful." So if you actually, if you go to France today, all throughout the Parisian churches, people are chuckling. So we brought this group into the president's conference room. And we went around the table and they all introduced themselves. And they came to me and I said to them, "You know, I am a student of medieval Jewish history. That's my PhD, is in medieval Jewish history. And having the Archbishop of Paris come to visit Yeshiva University has great historical significance. For 800 years ago, I know of other conversations that took place between the Archbishop and the Rabbi. And they were very different. I have a very different context. Now, I want to share with you, and this is what I told them, one of those conversations that took place 800 years ago between the Archbishop and the Rabbi. It's a story that's recorded in a book called Sefer Melchemet Mitzvah by Rav Meir ben Shimon Hami'ili, who was a great rabbi in Provence in the mid-13th century. And he wrote the Sefer, which recorded the conversations that he had with the Archbishop at the time. So, there are many significant passages. I took out a couple to focus on. You'll see, by the way, there are 6 pages of source sheets, so we'll be here all night going through them. Dinner is canceled. I will be selectively, you don't have to worry, I purposely put on the pages more than necessary so you could take them with you and study, continue our study afterwards. I selected a couple of these passages. Let me give you some background. So the background is, in this story, is that King Louis IX, who was the king of France, he was actually Saint Louis, known as Saint Louis, he abolished all interest, all debts that charged interest. Now, why did he abolish all debts that charged interest? Because the Christians understand, and they understand this from a passage in Tehillim and Psalms, that taking interest is prohibited across the board. You're not allowed to take interest. That's why Jews, who are prohibited to do other professions, ended up as moneylenders, because the Christians couldn't charge interest. The Jews were able to charge interest. Well, King Louis said that he's abolishing all debts. Now, what that means is that any Jewish moneylender, all of a sudden, is out Parnassa and is in deep trouble. Now, this takes place in Provence, which is the south of France, and it's not under King Louis's rule. So what King Louis tried to do is to convince the Archbishop in Provence to similarly annul all the debts. And what we have in this passage is a recording of a conversation that the Archbishop had with the rabbi, with Hami'ili, about this topic. So if you look at source number 1. "Concerning the matter of usury, since it is a sin, he knew that his soul and the souls of those attempting to preserve it would be punished on the day of judgment before the Lord. This he knew from the King of France. Indeed, the Archbishop," meaning he's talking about himself, "is not so wise as the King in their faith and from the rest of their leaders. In fact, although the King needs to accumulate silver and gold to give to his troops, nonetheless, he removes Jewish usury from the land. He does not desire silver and gold through it. Therefore, what shall we be able to answer against him on the day of judgment?" So the Archbishop is saying, the King of France is a very pious man, and he says that our religion directs us to annul all of the debts. And he's telling me to do that also. And that seems like the right thing to do. So why shouldn't I do it? And then he takes a step further and he says, now consider well. Do you have a brother or a sister among your co-religionists who could rescue you from the despoliation of the Seneschal and his officers, who just this year sought to drive you from your spacious homes and to send you forth naked and unclothed into the cold? Indeed, he sought to hold your wealthy men in prison until they redeem themselves with what they were thought to have safeguarded elsewhere, or until they circulate through the villages and towns at the doorsteps of Jews or of those you deem foreigners, that they release to them their funds illegally, in fact, as concerns usury. Indeed, they, the Christians, were better than brothers standing by you in your hour of trial. Now, let's give some background. The Archbishop knew the halacha. What is the halacha when it comes to usury for a Jew? Are we allowed to charge interest? Not to Jews. Why are we not allowed to charge interest to Jews? Say again?
The Torah says you can't charge interest.
So what does the Torah say exactly? Does the Torah say you can't charge interest to Jews? Say again? La'achicha lo tashich. You can't charge interest to your brother. Who can you charge interest to? What does the Torah say? To a nachri. So the Archbishop says to Hamili, let me understand this. Am I not your brother? Because last year, when the lords of the city stood up to imprison your wealthy men, I was the one who protected you. Am I not your brother? I'd want to know that. That's the position that the Archbishop put Hamili in. Okay, and this is indicative of what was going on at that period of time. At that time, the Talmudic law, was beginning to become known to the Christians. How was Talmudic law beginning to become known to the Christians? Because of those that converted from Judaism to Christianity. And all of a sudden, laws or statements in the Talmud that were not known are now becoming public. And the Christians are a little upset about them. So for example, if you look at the next page, the Archbishop says to the rabbi, indeed you must acknowledge that as you judge me, so I may judge you. Now behold, it's written in your Talmud that robbery of the Gentiles, theft from the Gentiles, and the Gentiles' funds are all permitted to you. Also concerning the return of lost goods, you say that such goods belong to you and need not be returned to their owners. Since this is your view of us, we may likewise judge you, failing to return your loans and even that which Gentiles robbed from you. Now, if Gezel Goy is permitted, if you don't have to return our lost objects, so we won't return your lost objects. And all of the debts that you say we owe you, we won't pay you. This is the position that the Jews found themselves, and this is what has led to the burning of the Talmud. It's led to public debates. Right? It's all in this spirit. So what I want to share with you in the few minutes that we have are how the rabbis, or some very prominent rabbis, addressed this situation. Now, it's not a situation that they could avoid. In some sense, they were pressed. And they were pressed to answer it, just to be clear, not just from the Christian side, because the majority wanted to understand and ask them to explain it, but also internally. They had to explain it to themselves. Morally, with conscience. How are we supposed to act? How are we supposed to act to our fellow Jews? How are we supposed to act to our society that is around us? And in this period, in this 100 years, in the 13th century, a number of great rabbis formulated responses to this question. This is the context for the question. So if you look, for example, at... let's skip a little. Let's go to the Ramban. If you look at example for at source number 14, you have the position of the Ramban, who explains again, Ribbit, we know, it says you can charge interest to your brother, you can charge to an Akhri. The question is, how do you define Akhri? By the way, how would you define Akhri? What's an Akhri? And in here. Wow, okay, interesting. Ovde Avodah Zara. Somebody who worship idols. Any other stab at what Nachri means? Say again? The stranger. So Nachri is the stranger, or he's somebody who's Ovid Avodah Zara. Interesting. Any other shots at what Nachri means? Gentile. Interesting. Totally different definition. Gentile. Okay, these are very ambiguous words. And the rabbis had to define what the... I mean, there's a whole... I could give a years-long class on each of these words. Like the word guy evolved over time, what guy means. And nachri, what nachri means, is also a fascinating conversation. So let's look... We'll look inside for a couple of the shitot, just to flesh it out a little bit. So the Ramban says in source number 14, "Ubiir bakan shehi ribit anachri mutar, v'lo izkir kain begezel begneva kamo shamru gezel gai asur, aval ribit shehu na'aseh ledat shneim ubritzonam, lo ne'asar el mitzara achva v'chesed." So the Ramban says that ribit is mutar to a non-Jew, but stealing is asur. Why? Because charging interest is a deal done between two parties. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just extra chesed, it's kind, to not do it. And what the Ramban does is he differentiates between two levels. There is mishpat, there is justice, which applies to everyone. You have to treat everyone with mishpat, with justice. And then there's another layer called chesed. And kindness, only you're only chayev to act with kindness to your brother, in this case defined as members of the Jewish family. So you can mishpat, you can't steal from anyone. But then there's a higher level, chesed, is to your Jewish family. That's how the Ramban says it. If you look at the Radak in source number 13, the Radak adds a very important nuance. He also similarly, and actually predates the Ramban, distinguishes between mishpat and chesed. If you look at on the fourth line, third word to the end of the line, we'll just skip. V'lo kein Yisrael im hagoy. Ki eno chayav asot imo chesed, o avot lo memano b'chinam. That a Jew is only chayav to act with chesed to his fellow Jew, but not to a guy that he has to act with mishpat. Why? Ki barov heim sonim Yisrael. Because most of them hate Jews. Avo bevadai, im osa hagoy chesed betova im Yisrael, chayav asot Yisrael gamkein imo chesed ulehitivlo. The Radak says, Rav David Kimchi, a rabbi from Provence, earlier in the Ramban, says that you act towards the non-Jew in the way that he acts towards you. Now, while there's a distinction between mishpat and chesed, The distinction is because in the world that the Radak was in, most of them hate Jews. And therefore, you don't have to act with greater chesed or greater kindness. But if in fact they are acting to us with kindness, then it is prohibited. Then you must also act with them with kindness. And it sounds like you cannot charge them ribbit. So what you have over here is a nuanced understanding of these double layers. It's not across the board. It's not mishpat on the one hand and chesed on the other. But it's those that hate us and those that don't. It's a whole other paradigm. It's not a world that's divided by Goy versus Yehudi, but it's the interaction which defines it. A little later, the Meiri goes even a step further. I'll just say the Meiri outside, or maybe we'll say it in English, actually. If you look at the Meiri in source number 16, the bottom of source number 16, I'll look at the bottom of the underlines. The Meiri says that it is prohibited to charge interest to anyone, I mean to all, to Jews, but it's permitted to all non-Jews. But anyone who belongs to the nations restricted by ways of religion and who serves God in any way, even if their belief is very different from ours, are not included in the rules of returning lost objects, for example, but are completely like Jews in such matters, including the obligation of returning lost items. Meiri adds a whole other layer. He says that there are three different groups of people. There is certain laws that apply only to your fellow Jews, like charging ribbit and charging interest. Then there are other rules, like returning lost objects, which are chesed. But they include anyone whose character, in his language, who are part of the nations that are restricted by religion. Anyone who's part of the nations that are restricted by religion are people that you have to act towards with kindness. And the ones that you don't, that you have to do mishpat, are those that are not restricted, but people who are idol worshippers. So the Meiri, in one fell swoop, places, for example, Christians as all his neighbors, and the category of those who are restricted by the ways of religion, and are people that you have to act towards with kindness, with chesed. And why does the Meiri do that? Because the Meiri believes that if you're restricted by the ways of religion, then you are a moral person. That in his frame, if you believe in God, and that God watches and punishes and rewards, then that keeps one on the straight and narrow, and that is someone that we have something deeply in common with. He is a member of a shared moral community. And a member of the shared moral community is someone that we need to reward and act with chesed and act with kindness. And what you have in these Rishonim who are working out the narrative, how is it that a Jew and the non-Jew, how are we supposed to work with this world? In what extent are our relationships with our fellow Jewish family members different? And they are. And in what extent do we see a non-Jewish world and we differentiate? It's not just non-Jews versus Jews. Okay, but there are different kinds of non-Jews. There are those that hate us and that attack us. And there are those that are our fellow moral human beings. And how we act towards the different groups depends much on their character. Now, I was in Israel over Sukkot, and there was a comedian who is from LA. I forgot his name. He actually went to MTA. I was so happy he didn't know I was in the room. And he said this, he goes, you know, it's an amazing thing, the Jewish people. What's the percent of Jews around the world? What's the percent of Jews? Point something. And yet when we look at the world, we say, there are Jews, and then there are non-Jews. It's like, if anything, you know, there's the Gentiles, and then there's the non-Gentiles. And we're like this little percentage of the people. Like, how is it they're the non-Jews. And I thought it was really perceptive, not just funny, but in halacha, and what the rabbis in Provence were teaching us, is that actually the world is divided. It's not just Jews and non-Jews. There are different categories. There are those that hate us. There are those that are our fellow moral human beings. And then there's also your Jewish family. And you need to mediate your contacts and relationships depending on who you're speaking with, depending on the context of the relationship. And that it's not just true that you need to act with chesed to just Jews, but you have to act with chesed to a greater group. And we have more in common with a greater group. And I mentioned this all tonight, and with this I'll begin to close, because I think that we are faced in a context today where it's important to consider our broader world around us and what are our responsibilities. You know, it's a scary time in many senses, with the rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiments. We're talking before about the spirit on college campuses and every other college campus, and how dangerous it is and how fearful it is for Jews in general, and certainly for Zionists. And in this context, it's important to remember to differentiate. And this is what we think about when we educate the leaders, the Jewish leaders in the world of tomorrow, as we educate our next generation of Jews, our next generation of Jewish leaders, that they have to fight hate and anti-Semitism and treat how they are being treated. And by the way, at YU, we've now opened up cybersecurity and data analytics, and our students have projects. We're going to be giving them projects to literally fight online and not just be victims, but to out those that seek to hurt us. Like, we need to use the tools that are at our disposal and be vigilant in what today is about. And we need that. But at the same time, we also need to separate out our allies and our friends, who are enormous. It's actually incredible. The people who are interested in helping the Jewish people, the people who are interested in our ideas and our ideals, and if anything, that has surprised me the most in walking around the country, are the amount of interest in Jewish values and what we stand for. Like, people want to hear it. And we have an opportunity to be impactful today in ways that perhaps we've never had before. And then there's the third group, which is our Jewish family, and our responsibility to spread our values to the broader Jewish community. And we can't just be thinking about our lives just in our narrow context of ourselves. But what is our responsibility to spread our values to our people who are in desperate need of examples of what we stand for? You know, I was recently at a meeting with our Rosh Yeshiva, and one of them said to me that in addition to Torah Mada, perhaps we should add a new banner which is Torah v'Kiddush Hashem. Because what we're doing is we're educating our leaders for the world of tomorrow to sanctify God's name in this world. To do so with the context of thinking about their community, the broader Jewish people, and all of society. We have a 3,000-year-old tradition of great wisdom, filled with values, teachings, and traditions. In our rapidly changing world, people are seeking stability and clarity, meaning and morality. In our lives, filled often with the numbing quality of routine and living on autopilot, people long for purpose and significance. In a world of the ephemeral, people seek the eternal. All of this is found in our tradition and teachings. And we must not only study this for ourselves, but to bring our values out into the world. And we live in an era in which we are uniquely capable of doing so. We live in an era in which global communications have made Torah and all knowledge more accessible to greater numbers of people than ever before, in which we benefit from some of the most remarkable technological advances in the history of humanity, in which the relationship between Jews and others in the world have shifted. Where once we might have looked at our neighbors and only saw persecutors, today we might look at them and see potential partners. Whether it's the Archbishop of Paris, the President of Fordham University, imams, the U.S. military, people are interested. Jews are interested. We are marching forward in history with the entree to participate and contribute and take a leadership role in the global moral discourse like never before seen in history. And we need to educate our students and the next generation with a sense of mission and purpose, that they are part of something greater. Torah v'Kiddush Hashem. They could go out and sanctify God's name in this world, bring our values out into the world, and push history forward. You know, at YU, we have an army of thousands of students who are proud of their Jewish identity, ardent Zionists, fully conversant with our contemporary culture, and deeply rooted in our traditions and values. We're educating the Jewish leadership of tomorrow by endowing them with the will and wherewithal to make a significant impact on an ever-changing world. And this is our collective mission. And this is what is happening at the YU Torah Mitzion Kolel. What's happening is that people learn to be proud of their values. Okay, to be proud of your values. Ki chachmatchem ubinatchem. It is what makes us different. We have a purpose in this world. There's a reason why the Jewish people exist. And it's places like in this kolel where we learn not just the depth of the values, but we learn to cherish them and to have the confidence to bring them out into the world. That's what we're about. You know, one of the things, and with this I'll close, that I have a strange enjoyment is the few times where I've had to eat kosher in clearly a foreign environment. So last week I was invited by the president of a New York university to come to their campus house with six other presidents to greet a new president of a university into our community of presidents of universities. So my office said, okay, Rabbi Berman loves to do that. You need to have kosher food for him. So they ordered the kosher food, and this is like my sense of humor, I guess. I love when they bring me the kosher food, and I insist that they bring it fully wrapped, so I could make the biggest mess in the world. And they're all sitting around and I'm cutting and ripping up the plastic and the aluminum foil, and like it's like crazy. What's going on? And then we could talk about being kosher and what it means that Hashem gave us these mitzvot, and how we're living with these mitzvot, and I'm proud of these mitzvot. You know, but just as important of tearing and ripping and making the public mess of what it means to keep kosher is turning to the waiter and looking him in the eye and saying, thank you. Because no one should ever leave an encounter with you without being better for it. And that's what it means to live a life of values in Torah. Torat Emet and Torat Chesed. To be proud of what we stand for. And to live our lives being emblematic and exemplifying what we stand for. This is our task. And this is our collective mission. This is what is taught in this wonderful kollel. And this is what we're celebrating here tonight. What we're celebrating is a kollel and a community that stands for, that cherishes our values, and that brings our values out into this world. And that's why it's a special schut for me to be here with you tonight. Mazel tov on this wonderful occasion. May you only be zocha for more great things to come. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Berman. We invite everybody to go either through that door or those doors straight to dinner. Thank you.